So literally Mark says Jesus created the apostles. He made the apostles. He made from what they were not something that they now are. We all have those childhood memories, you know, those really old memories that go way back to those days when we were just barely old enough to begin remembering things. And most of those memories are just little, like a little flash or just a little moment that might just be fuzzy in our minds, in which we just have this briefest of memories of those young days of our life. Well, I have those too, you have those too, but I have this one childhood memory that is not just a little flash of a memory, it is a vivid, full memory. And it comes from the days when I was 6 years old in the first grade. And on this particular memory, I am standing on the line between home plate and first base. And we're doing that little exercise that we all did way back in the ancient days when I was in the first grade, back in the 1970s, where the coach or the teacher, the PE teacher, would choose the two most athletic kids in the class. And they would pick the team to play kickball. And so those guys were picking the team. And here I am standing on the first baseline. And of course, as the story goes, I'm the last one to be picked. Now, I remember that story vividly. I can tell you the weather on that day. It was overcasty and cold. I can tell you the name of those two kids, Ricky and Timmy. I can tell you the name of the teacher, Mr. Forsythe. And I can just tell you all those other kids that were picked and just the anxiety, you know what I'm talking about, is every other kid is picked and then it comes down to me and then there's this fight between the other two kids about who was going to get me. Not that they both wanted me, but they were fighting over who would have to take me. And then Mr. Forsythe steps in and makes one of the teams take me. And then I hear this big audible gasp from the team that is awarded me to their team. And that memory is just there, you know, it's just almost like it happened a year ago. So that's one of those memories that will, I guess, probably last me till the end of my life. But that was a type of a choosing that stands out in my mind. Today's passage that we look at in Mark chapter 3 is another kind of choosing altogether. That one goes back some 46, 47 years ago. This one goes back about 2,000 years, and this doesn't take place on a playground. This one takes place on a mountainside. So we turn to Mark chapter 3 this morning, beginning from verse 13. And in this passage, there's going to be a choosing. In fact, this is a dual choosing that we'll see in the passage to us this morning. But before we read our passage, let's remind ourselves of the context that Mark is taking us through. In this section, Mark is interested to wrestle with us about the question of not only who is this man Jesus, but what explains this radically polar opposite reaction to him? What explains the fact that some people are conspiring, some Israelites are conspiring with Israel's enemy to illegally kill a fellow Israelite while others are flocking to him? We saw last week just the immensity of the crowd that's flocking to Jesus last week. And then there's the reaction of the demons as they recognize who he is and Jesus commands them to silence. So this polar opposite of reactions, Mark's taking us through this. And the point that he's going to show us is that these two reactions are springing from two different hearts. One heart that is fundamentally opposed to the work of the Spirit. The next passage is going to take us there when we enter into that passage that we often think of as the unpardonable sin. We'll see when we look at that, that's not really what we think it is. But this passage known as the unpardonable sin, which has to do with those who are opposed in their heart to the work of the Spirit. Jesus is compared to one who's possessed of demons. And then we're going to see at the end of our passage today, even Jesus' family come and they believe that he's out of his mind. And so this is all speaking to us of some people who in their heart are vehemently opposed to the work of the Spirit in their heart, and then others who aren't. And this is what explains the different reactions for us. So in our passage today, this is going to show us a different reaction to Jesus. This is the reaction to Jesus of those who are called and then those who are chosen as apostles before him. So let's begin from reading our passage from verse 13. I'll read down through verse 21 and then we'll begin taking it apart. So from verse 13, and he, Jesus, went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired. And they came to him And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. He appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, son of thunder, Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James, the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus and Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again so that he could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, "He is out of his mind." So as we enter into this section, this passage from Mark chapter 3 this morning, let's remind ourselves of sort of the larger tracking context, and that's the context of the strong man. This is sort of a theme of Mark's, is the return of the strong man. The strong man is going to be that parable that Jesus tells in the very next section as he's explaining why he's being attacked. These people are saying that you are must be possessed of demons to be casting out demons like you are. And so then Jesus tells that short parable about the strong man, how the strong man, in order for the strong man to be cast out, a stronger man has to come. And so Jesus is that stronger man. He is the rightful king. He is the rightful ruler, and a lesser strong man has come into his kingdom and taken over his kingdom and is ruling illegally in his kingdom. But the greater strong man has now come, and the greater strong man is casting out the weaker strong man, the lesser strong man. And so in this passage, what we see here before us is that the strong man is now reclaiming his kingdom. He is reclaiming his kingdom. Look at verse 13. And he went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. So Jesus here is beginning the process of reclaiming his kingdom. We'll see this in a number of ways through verses 13 and particularly verses 14. So we begin by seeing Jesus is going up on the mountain. And so when Jesus goes up on the mountain, Mark says he goes up on the mountain, and he says it as though that's a mountain that his readers would have known what mountain he's talking about, because notice he doesn't name the mountain, neither do Matthew or Luke. So the mountain is unnamed, but Mark says he doesn't go up on a mountain. He says he goes up on the mountain as though this is something everyone would have known. You'd have known, I guess, if you were one of Mark's original readers, what mountain he was talking about. It doesn't matter to us what mountain it is, but as he goes up on this mountain, that's our first clue that something very significant and something very important is about to happen. Because we have been trained by the scriptures to recognize that when the scene shifts to a mountain, either divine revelation is about to take place or something very significant spiritually is about to take place. Mark has taught us this already, but in fact, we're going to see this emphasized throughout the remainder of Mark's gospel, is that when we see the scene shift to a mountain, we know that something very significant spiritually is happening. Just to kind of take a brief look ahead, chapter 6 and verse 46, he goes up on the mountain to pray. That's the night that the storm comes and he's going to walk on the water. Mark chapter 9 and verse 2, he goes up on to the high mountain. They go up on the mountain with James and Peter and John, and that's the Mount of Transfiguration where Jesus is transfigured before them. Mark chapter 11 and verse 1, they go to the Mount of Olives, and he sends two of his disciples to the Mount of Olives. That's when he is entering into the city for the triumphal entry. Mark chapter 13, verse 3, he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple and gives the Olivet Discourse. Chapter 14, verse 26, they go out to the Mount of Olives on the night of his arrest, and we could go on. But clearly, Mark is painting for us a picture of mountaintop, mountainside equals revelation and spiritual significance. And Mark is not the only writer to do this. All the gospel writers do this. And in fact, all of scripture does this. Just a really brief overview here. Chapter 11, verse 29 of Deuteronomy, we're given the parable of the two mountains, the mountain of good, the mountain of evil. In Genesis chapter 22 and verse 2, that's Abraham taking the son of promise, Isaac, up on the mountain to sacrifice him. 1 Kings chapter 18, that's the conflict, this grand conflict between good and evil with Elijah there on Mount Carmel. One chapter later, 1 Kings chapter 19, that's once again Elijah on the mountain when the Son of God comes and meets with him. Exodus chapter 19, verse 3, that's the giving of the law for God's people on Mount Sinai. Later on, Moses will meet again with God on the mountain. Zechariah 14 and verse 4, that is the return of Christ when he is said to return onto a mountain. And that is just a very small sampling. I could literally fill up your entire handout with references from the scriptures about mountains and spiritual significance, mountains and revelation points from God. And this isn't, by the way, this is not unique to Christianity. Other faiths also have a high view, no pun intended, a high view of mountaintops. And oftentimes other faiths will attach significance to mountaintops as well. So I don't want to confuse you by leading you to believe that only Christianity and Judaism think of mountaintops in this way. But it is to say this, when the Bible mentions a mountaintop, our attention should be focused on what's about to happen, because that's a signal for us that something significant is about to happen. And what's about to happen in this passage is one of the most significant days of Jesus' entire life on earth. This is, without a doubt, one of the five most significant days of Jesus' life, if not one of the three or two most significant days of Jesus' life. If we were to make a list of the most significant days of Jesus' earthly life, we would have to include, of course, his baptism. We would have to take a look at the day he was transfigured on the mountain. We would, of course, look to his arrest and crucifixion, his resurrection. But we would also have to look at this day before us here. In fact, this would, I believe, put together with the day of his death, burial, and then together with the resurrection day, this would be the two most significant days of Jesus' life. This is a tremendously significant day. What we are witnessing on the side of this mountain is something that can really be seen as a crossroads in all of human history, a crossroads in the life of God's people. A new thing will be born on this mountainside today, something that continues to this day and something that's extraordinarily significant. The significance of this day can be seen on the fact that Jesus goes to the mountainside, but also it can be seen if we take a look at Luke's gospel, and we see how Luke tells us that prior to this night, Jesus spent the entire night in prayer. One of only two occasions that Jesus is said to spend the whole night in prayer. Of course, the other would be Gethsemane and the night of the arrest. This being the other night in which we're told that not only did Jesus rise early to pray, but he spent the entire night in prayer. If we were to look at Luke's words in Luke chapter 6 and verse 12, we read there that all night he continued in prayer. Now, we might be led to believe from that English word continue that Jesus prayed throughout the night. Maybe we've had a similar sort of experience. Maybe you've had some trouble sleeping, something's weighing heavily on your mind, you pray for a while, then maybe you doze off and wake up a little bit later and it's still on your mind, you pray some more, maybe you get up and get some water, get a cup of coffee or something like that, and you pray some more, and you think of that as praying throughout the night. This is not what Luke is saying. Luke uses a word here, translated continued, but it's a word that really has the significance, it has the meaning of enduring throughout the night. This is not a word that would be used to describe something that happens all night that's not this enduring sort of thing. For example, you would not use this word to describe how you might have left the light on all night and the light continued to burn all night. Or you wouldn't use this word to describe how your neighbor's dog barked continually through the night. Instead, this word would mean that not only did you do this all through the night, but you labored constantly without leaving it. So Jesus endured through the night in prayer. He earnestly, in an agony of prayer, so to speak, prayed continually all night in preparation for this day. So that tells us something else of the significance of this day. It is a common understanding, we should say, among biblical scholars, that this event is also coupled together with the Sermon on the Mount. Now, Mark doesn't narrate the Sermon on the Mount for us, but it is a safe assumption that this event on the side of the mountain is coupled together with the Sermon on the Mount, so that Jesus' choosing of his disciples and his choosing of the apostles, together with that monumental teaching we know of as the Sermon on the Mount, all this was one day. So that Sermon on the Mount, we know of that as the most significant and the most important body of teaching that was ever given. The most significant and the most important sermon ever preached is the Sermon on the Mount, and this is taking place on this day. So we sort of get a feeling, a sense now of the weight of this day, of the importance of this day, but yet there is more. So we read here, he went up on the mountain and he called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. So the first thing that we see is a separation, so to speak, a reduction in the number of people. We said last week just how large and massive this crowd was and how intrusive was the crowd. They're pressing against Jesus, even to the point that it's almost dangerous. Jesus makes this way of escape with the boat, just in case the crowd presses against him too much. So we talked about just the sheer number and how people were coming as far away as 120 miles away from the land of Edom to the south. And so we talked about the size of the people here. Jesus was down by the Sea of Galilee here, and he's going to now separate himself from that larger, massive crowd. He's going to go up the hill, and then we're going to see that he's going to call unto himself some of that larger crowd, and he's going to separate some of them off unto himself. So what this calls to mind for me is the twofold reduction in number of Gideon's army. Remember that? There was this big army of, 30,000, and then it was reduced down, and then it was reduced down a second time to the 300. This, I think, harkens back to that reduction, that twofold reduction in number of Gideon's army and before he goes against the Midianites there. So this tells us of Jesus looking upon the crowd. All of this crowd has been drawn to Jesus for his healing. They are enamored with his healing powers, with his miraculous powers, and they've been drawn to him from places so far away, but it's a massive number of people. So Jesus wants to separate himself from that larger body of people that's drawn to him for his healing powers, and he wants to draw unto himself those whom we read here, whom he desired. He called them up the mountain to himself. So when he called them up the mountain, when he called to them, this is a word that speaks to not just in inviting them to come, just not just Jesus giving this sort of invitation, you want to come on up the mountain with me. This is a word that's often translated summoned. It carries with it not just a invitation, but it carries with it a distinct sense of authority. Mark will use this same word again in chapter 15 and verse 44 to speak of what Pilate does for the centurion. He summoned the centurion. Or Matthew will use this word in chapter 18 and verse 32 when he says that the master summoned to the servant. He summoned him to come here, and then he said, "You wicked servant." So it's a word that carries with it a distinct sense of an authority, summoning a subordinate unto himself. So he summoned them up unto himself, but it even is more distinctive than that. So Mark is going to use some words here, some language here, in which Mark is purposely trying to paint for us a picture of Jesus's exclusive sovereignty as he calls them unto himself. So the first thing that we see here is that he called to him. Now, that's the word aperkomai, and it has this prefix, A-P-E-R, aper. We use that in order to describe something that separates out that which we do not want and focuses in on that which we do want. For example, we use it in the word aperture. So think about an aperture on a camera or an aperture on a telescope. And what does an aperture do? An aperture lets you look through and focus on what you want, while it also eliminates out from your view that which you don't want. And this word carries that distinct sense. Not only is it a calling to come to me, but it's a calling to separate from them. So it's a twofold word here. It's saying not just come to me and bring everybody else with you, but come to me while separating yourself from them. It harkens us back to Genesis chapter 3, the whole command that's given to the man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. The same thing here, the same idea is not just the man, but this leaving and cleaving sort of thing. Jesus calls for them to leave the crowd and come unto himself. So that word is given to us in something that the Greek language calls the middle voice. Now, the middle voice, you don't need to know what this really means, but this is just to say this. The middle voice is what's used when the actor of the verb is also the object of the verb, when the actor of the verb is also the object. So we use the same sort of thing in English and all other languages, but what it's saying to us is that Jesus is not just giving the command, but he's specific to say that I'm the receiver of the action of that. So it's like he's saying he himself called unto himself those whom he desired. He himself called unto himself those whom he desired. And that word, those whom he desired, that is what the Greek language calls an intensive pronoun. So literally we could translate that, those whom he himself desired for himself. All right, so let me put all that together, and it's going to sound really awkward and really clumsy for you, but I'm going to translate it very literally and very, very woodenly. He himself called unto himself, or he himself summoned unto himself, those who he himself desired for himself. Now that sounds incredibly bulky and awkward and cumbersome, but that's the language that Mark is using. He himself summoned unto himself those who he himself desired for himself. So the picture that Mark is trying to paint for us is a picture of Jesus as the sole actor here, as the sole one. He desires for himself this people. He desires for himself these to be separated from the larger crowd. He's not telling the crowds to go away. He's not saying, I'm done with you. He's not saying, my healing is over. But what he's saying is, I can't do what I came to do with this number of people. I came to teach. I came to preach. I can't do that. And so I'm going to call unto myself those whom I desire for myself. I'm going to summon them unto myself, those who I desire to have for myself. This is most vividly and most clearly Mark painting for us a picture of the absolute sovereignty of God as Jesus chooses his followers. So this is not the choosing of the apostles yet. This is not the designation of the apostles. This is the designation of those who would be separate from the crowds, who are enthusiastic about Jesus. They're enamored with his healing powers. They're here to get healed. Everybody there is there to get healed. But this is separating from that crowd, those who are there only because they are drawn to Jesus' healing power. It's separating from those whom that Jesus would desire to be his followers. Those who would have a desire to be with Jesus and to be his follower and not just simply be healed by him. So it's this calling unto himself, this summoning unto himself. And notice that they all came, because when the sheep hear the shepherd's voice, the sheep respond to the shepherd's voice. So this is a clear picture of the doctrine of God's choosing. I didn't put it there. I'm not twisting any words to make it appear like it's there. I'm simply showing you what Mark wrote. If you are under the impression that the doctrine of God's choosing is something that only shows up in Ephesians and Romans, then here we have it in Mark chapter 3. Clearly, Mark is saying to us that Jesus chose for himself those whom he wanted to separate from the larger crowd to come to him to be his followers. And again, we're not yet to the apostles. We're just simply to those who will be followers of Jesus, who respond to his call, his sheep hear his voice, and they are set apart from the larger crowd. So this is the setting apart of the church. Now the church proper is born in Acts chapter 2, is it not? With the giving of the Spirit and the birth of the church. But in a real sense, we could trace the beginning of the church to Mark chapter 3. Because this group that's being set apart is the group that will become the church in Acts chapter 2. This is a designating, a setting apart of those who are committed to be followers of Christ. This is, if we really wanted to trace the roots of the beginning of the church, we could trace it to Acts 2, and we could trace it beyond Acts 2 right here to Mark chapter 3. This is the sovereign call of God upon these. If this call did not exist, then the church would not exist. So he calls them whom he desired, and they came to him. Now verse 14, and he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him and he might send them out to preach. So here is the choosing from among the smaller group. There was the bigger group, and the bigger group got a lot smaller with the smaller group. We're not told any information about how many were in that first reduction of numbers. But from that first reduction of numbers, there is now from among them the choosing, or the appointing, or the setting apart of the apostles, capital A. And he appointed, once again, verse 14, he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach, and they would have authority to cast out demons. So in this section, what we really see here, the strong man, he is here to recover his kingdom, so to speak. This kingdom that has been temporarily taken over by the false king, He's here to recover that. In this section, what we see is the reconstituting of the king, of the king's proper kingdom. This reconstituting of the kingdom. So the picture that we're being shown here is a picture of the kingdom of God's people that have become apostate, and the rightful king is returning, and he's reconstituting his rightful kingdom because his kingdom of Israel, so to speak, has become apostate. And so he's reconstituting the leadership. We see that, first of all, in just the number 12. That's impossible to miss the number 12. Because the number 12, Jesus could have picked 8 apostles. He could have picked 14 apostles. He could have picked 25 apostles. But he has 12 apostles, and it's inescapable that that number 12 corresponds to the other number 12 from the Old Covenant, which is the sons of Jacob, the tribes of Israel, the 12 tribes of Jacob. So the 12 tribes of Jacob were the nation of Israel. They were the Jewish people, so to speak. But those 12 tribes have become largely apostate. God's people, God's kingdom, still has a remnant of his true people. But as we've said over the last number of weeks, what Mark is showing us is that through the perversion of the law of God, through the perversion of the word of God, the doctrine of man righteousness, of works righteousness, has completely taken over the religious leadership in Israel. And so this works righteousness, that's what Jesus was talking about, the whole new wine in the old wineskins, the whole new patch in the old garment. That's what that was talking about. Remember how this gospel of grace cannot fit into not the old law, but the perversion of the old law, the man-centeredness that they have made the law to become, the works-centeredness of the law. The gospel of grace will not fit into that. As those two parables were teaching, it will destroy it. So this kingdom of God that's now become apostate, Jesus is here to reconstitute it. And by choosing these 12 apostles, Jesus is in essence rebuking the leadership of Israel to say that the leadership of Israel is completely off the rails, and I'm here to reestablish my kingdom. So he chooses these 12 apostles, and not only does he choose them, but it says that he appointed 12 whom he named apostles. So that word appointed sounds to us like Jesus picks among the larger group. Maybe there's 100 disciples that come up the mountain with him, and they sit and they hear this sermon of discipleship, this Sermon on the Mount that's all about discipleship. And among these hundreds that are here, 100 or so to hear the Sermon on the Mount, from that 100, Jesus is going to pick 12 of those. That's what it almost sounds like when we see that word appointed, because that's what appointed means. Appointed means to take from a larger group and set aside for a specific purpose. But if we look closely to the word that Mark uses here, Mark just uses the word poeo. Now, that word literally doesn't mean appoint, it means create. It means make. It's the same word. If we were to look at Genesis 1:1 in the Septuagint translation, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it's the same word that's used to say God created the heavens and the earth. So literally Mark says Jesus created the apostles. He made the apostles. He made from what they were not something that they now are. As we're going to see a little bit later in the text, he's going to take these men who are nothing like apostles, and he's going to make them into what they are not. He's creating something from nothing. He's creating apostles from men who are not apostles. So he appointed them. He made them. He created them. And this is the working out of what we see in John chapter 15, when Jesus says to the apostles, "You didn't choose me, I chose you." So a little bit later in John 17, Jesus is going to say to the Father, "The people that you gave me, I've kept them all." So the larger giving of a people to Jesus, that was the first choosing. This is what Jesus says in John chapter 15. To the apostles, he says to them, "You didn't choose me, I chose you and I appointed you." So this is the actual choosing that Jesus is talking about. So he appoints these 12, or he calls them, or he creates them. And we even see this theme carried into the naming. He says that he also named them apostles. And when we go through the list of names, we're going to see that a few of them are given new names by Jesus. Peter, Simon becomes Peter. James and John, he calls them the sons of thunder. And then even we speculated back when we were talking about Levi, I speculated that Jesus, I believe Jesus renamed Levi to Matthew, which means a gift from God. But there may be even others that we're not specifically told that Jesus renamed them, but we are told that Jesus gave some of them new names. But even the larger picture is that we're told that he named them apostles. So that harkens us back to God's naming of his creation. When we see that God called the day, day, and he called the night, night. He named his creation. And we know that in the scriptures, the duty of naming, the task of naming, has to do with authority. That the one in authority always is the one to name the one who's subjected to the authority. So God names his creation. Jesus names his apostles. So we see in the even the naming, what we are shown here is the picture that Jesus is the absolute sovereign creator, not only of those who are now his followers, but he's the absolute sovereign creator of the apostles. He names them. He calls the disciples. They hear his voice. They obey. He prays to the Father later. All those whom you gave me have come to me. He then names the apostles. He creates the apostles and gives them this name. He is shown emphatically as the creator, as the sovereign creator. So they come to him. And now we see from verse 15, he's going to give them authority to cast out demons. We'll come back to that. And now verse 16, here we're going to see the names. He appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot. And we'll stop right there for the moment. So we could take some time and we could look at each of those names individually. I don't think that's really the best use of our time to look at them individually. Maybe just call attention to a couple of things that are kind of easy to see there. We see some of the renaming that takes place. Simon's going to become Peter. Petros, which comes from Petra Rock. Okay, and we see there very clearly that what Jesus is doing is he's not naming Peter according to his character, because Peter does not have this rock-like, immovable, resolute character. He's just the opposite. But instead, he's naming him according to what he will become. So Peter is named the Rock because not because he is so rock-like, but because he will become rock-like. Or the sons of thunder. We can kind of see the relationship there. James and John, we know from Luke chapter 6, where they want to call down fire upon the Samaritan village that wouldn't believe in Jesus, you know, hearkening back to Elijah days. So we kind of see that. But then we also see James and John, or James is going to be the first martyr. So we sort of see that sons of thunder, that impetuousness, that refusal to be bridled kind of thing. James is going to be the first one who will refuse to cow down to the Roman authorities, and he's going to preach the gospel anyway, and he's going to be the first one martyred. John, of course, he's going to write the Revelation. Now, oftentimes we think about John as sort of this really gentle disciple of love. You know, the epistles of John are very gentle, but the Apocalypse is not so gentle. So this is James and John. They're the sons of thunder. They are the unbridled ones, so to speak. And we can kind of see some other things there. But the last thing to draw attention to before we go to the 12th name would be Simon the Zealot. And just to kind of think for a moment about the interplay that would have existed between Simon the Zealot and, say, for example, Matthew. Simon is called Simon the Zealot because he is associated with a group of people who will become a political party in a couple of decades after Jesus' death, a political party that will be known as the Zealots. And the Zealots were known for their pro-Israel stance. In fact, their violent pro-Israel stance. They were known to be assassins and terrorists, that kind of thing. Simon is associated with that group that will eventually become the Zealots. So he's called Simon the Zealot here. So we take this to be somebody who's very, very pro-Israel, even to the point of embracing violence. Now, we put that together with this man, Matthew, the tax collector. And it doesn't take a whole lot for us to imagine just a very thorny relationship there, apart from the gospel. Two people who were more diametrically opposed, it would be hard to imagine them being together, than Matthew, the tax collector, and Simon, the pro-Israel zealot. So imagine Simon the Zealot and Matthew, the former tax collector, they're going to sleep in close proximity to one another. They're going to share a table together. They are going to be an example for us of just what the gospel can bring together, of how the gospel transcends all cultural boundaries. It transcends all human divisions, and it brings together those who never would have been brought together otherwise. So that's a little bit about Simon the Zealot and Matthew. And again, we could dig more deeply into a lot of those names, or all those names if you wanted. But just suffice to say that of those 12 names, here's the list of 12 apostles. Only four of them are going to be mentioned ever again in Mark's gospel: Simon, James, and John, and of course, number 12, Judas. Other than those four, the other eight, Mark will never mention them again, which is interesting. These 12 apostles, seven of them, their name is only mentioned one time. Matthew is only mentioned one time, and he's mentioned again elsewhere as Levi. But then eight of the apostles are only mentioned right here in all of Mark's gospel. So now let's just turn our attention finally to the final number 12, the most problematic apostle, verse 19, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. So Judas Iscariot, we all are quite familiar with that name. Judas Iscariot, because that's a name that's just emblazoned upon the Christian conscience as the one who was the betrayer of our Lord. So we're told that Judas the betrayer is among the 12 who were chosen. On all the lists of the apostles, he's always last, he's always the 12th one, and he's always designated as the betrayer. The apostles, the gospel writers, by the way, as just sort of a side note, the gospel writers are far harsher towards Judas than Jesus ever is. That's just something to kind of ponder. Jesus is never as harsh to Judas as the writers of the gospel will be. So here is Judas called the betrayer, the one who would betray him. So the question really looms large: why would Jesus choose Judas? We reject outright the concept that Jesus didn't know that Judas would betray him. We reject that. Jesus not only knew he would be betrayed, he knew he would be betrayed by one of his own, and he knew it would be Judas. And so Jesus didn't choose Judas hoping that he would be faithful, like he hoped the other 11 would be faithful. He chose Judas knowing. So what are we to make of this? This extremely problematic and even, should I say, embarrassing choice by our master to choose out of only 12. He had hundreds to choose from, and of the 12 he picked, one of them was a betrayer. So one of the things that this shows us very clearly is, once again, I love pointing this out, the authenticity of the true gospels. Because if this were a man-written gospel, there is no way that we would have included such an embarrassing detail about our master. If people put this together, if people made this up, that would have absolutely been washed out of the story. But it's here. All the gospels have it. And so clearly this is another mark of the authenticity of the divine nature. God is not embarrassed that Jesus chose a betrayer. He intended to choose a betrayer. So that's the first thing that we see. Another thing that I want to point out just real quickly is Jesus's association with Judas, or should I say the other way around, Judas's close association with Jesus, and how Judas stands for us as a stark reminder that close association with Jesus is not necessarily proof of grace. Close association with Jesus does not necessarily say that we are under the grace, the salvific grace of God. To be closely associated with Jesus, or in our day, to be closely associated with his people, in no way declares that we are necessarily one of God's. Judas was closely associated with Jesus. Judas was one of the 12 the entire time. The 12 were chosen by Jesus, we're told in Acts chapter 1, because they were with Jesus from the start. So Judas wasn't a latecomer. He was here from the start, and he was there until the end. So this close association with Jesus, oftentimes, you know, we can look at this the other way around. And we can know that those who want no association with God's people, it's really problematic to think of one who wants nothing to do with God's people as being among God's people. It's hard to imagine one who loves Jesus and does not want any association with his bride. But you can't really think of it the other way around, because there are many tares that have close association with the people of God, and that in no way is necessarily evidence of salvation. The other thing that we see is, in addition to that, not only close association with Jesus, but doing mighty things in Jesus' name is not necessarily proof of any salvation. As Jesus will say to those who come to him and say, "Didn't we do many mighty great things in your name? I never knew you. Depart from me." So Judas will do many mighty things in Jesus' name. How do we know that? Well, we know from this passage that they're given the authority, we'll get here in just a minute, the authority to preach and the authority to cast out demons. Later in chapter 8, as the 12 are going to be finally sent out, they're going to be given more authority to heal the sick. And so these disciples, these apostles, are going to be sent out in twos to preach and to cast out demons and to heal. Never once is there a shred of evidence that any of the disciples, or any of the apostles, I should say, suspected Judas was the betrayer. Remember when Jesus says, "One of you will betray me"? Not one of them said, "I knew it." Judas never did cast out any demons. Did you see Judas try to cast it? Did you see him? He couldn't cast out demons. Remember that time we were casting out demons and Judas tried and he couldn't do it? Or Judas, he never was able to heal anybody. All the rest of us, we were healing. Not Judas, though. Or did you ever hear Judas preach? He was not a very powerful preacher. I knew it was him. There's not a shred of evidence that any of the apostles suspected him in any way, which tells us very clearly that he did everything they did. He preached powerfully. He cast out demons. He healed the sick. No one suspected a thing. So once again, this shows us that we can even do great things for the kingdom of God from an earthly perspective, and that is not necessarily proof of regeneration. So let's look just a little bit more closely into this character, Judas. Verse 19 again, "And Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him." Judas Iscariot is a very interesting character for us. So we think about this name Judas. What a lot of scholars point to is they point to Judas as being chosen by Jesus for the purpose of representing all the Jewish people. Now, that might be new. That's not something that we necessarily hear every day. But a lot of biblical scholars think that Judas was Jesus' choice as sort of a stand-in for all of the Jews. The first thing that we see here is we see something about his name, the name Judas. If we were to look at this, it's in your notes here. But in the Greek, Judas's name is Judas, whereas the name of Jew is Judas. You hear how close those two are? Judas, Judas. And so it's really only a half of a syllable difference. So his name really is almost indicative of the people who will betray him. Furthermore, Judas is the only Judean Jew among the 12 disciples. All other 11 disciples or apostles are Galilean Jews. Judas is the only Judean Jew. He comes, we believe, from a town called Kirioth, which would be in the southern part of Judah near the land of Edom. So he's the only Judean Jew. Now, the Judean Jews were known as sort of the highbrow Jews. The Galilean Jews, they were sort of the stepchild. They were the ones who were kind of, well, I guess they're Jews, but we, the Judean Jews, we are the real Jews. This is where Jerusalem is. This is where the land of Judah, this is the land that stayed faithful to God in the Old Testament, or more so than the Northern Kingdom did. So the Judean Jews, the Southern Jews, they're sort of the highbrow. They're sort of the ones who think of themselves as the real Jews, the true Jews. And Judas is the only one among them. And then his name itself is so close to the very name of the people. So many people think of that and they speculate, Jesus chose him as a representative of all of the people who will betray him. And who betrayed him? His own. He came unto his own, and his own knew him not. And his own were the ones who gave him over to the Gentiles. So that sort of has some traction with me. I don't know if it has a lot of traction with you, but it has some traction with me to think of Jesus choosing the one whom will be literally the symbolic stand-in for all of the people who will reject him, and that's the one who will betray him. And furthermore, we see some more similarities with this man, Judas, because if we think through the story, we know how Judas betrays Jesus, and after betraying Jesus, he destroys himself, he kills himself. So also, after Israel betrayed Jesus, they also destroyed themselves within about three decades through their foolish resistance to Rome, and that eventually ended up in their total destruction. Or we think of Judas, who was the trusted keeper of the money. Remember how Judas was the trusted keeper of the money? So also were the Jews the trusted keeper of God's treasure, the Scriptures. And there's other parallels that we see. There's many parallels that say to us, I think there's something to this, that Jesus is choosing Judas as the symbolic stand-in for the very people who would betray him. And Jesus wanted to take this man as though symbolically taking all of his people into his confidence, into his close association, to share table with him, to break bread with him, to sleep with him, to walk with him, to do all these things with him, and then yet to betray him for 30 pieces of silver. And I think this is really what Judas is pointing us to. So Jesus chooses Judas for Judas to come alongside as this betrayer from close among him. The word that he betrayed him, the word betray there is the paradidomi. It has the prefix of para, which means alongside. Didomai means to turn over or to give over. Para means alongside. We use that same sort of prefix for like a paramedic, alongside a doctor, or paralegal, alongside a lawyer, or paramilitary. So Judas betrayed him. Paradidomai, alongside of him, gave him over. Betrayed him from within. One of his own gave him over. In fulfillment of the Scriptures, we think of Psalm 41. One who breaks my bread with me and eats at the table with me, he will be the one who turns me over. Or as Jesus will say to Judas when Judas comes there to betray him with the kiss, he will say in Matthew 26, friend, what are you doing? So Jesus chooses the 12 here. He creates this apostleship. He sets them apart. One of them he knows all along to be a betrayer. But now let's look back up to verse 14 again. And he appointed, or he created 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. So let's look finally at this, what they're appointed to. They're appointed to, first of all, to be with Jesus. So let's not miss out on that. They're appointed, or they're created as this group of apostles to be with Jesus. The larger group of disciples is not said to be chosen to be with Jesus. They're chosen to come to him. But the apostles are created or chosen to be with him. And so this being with Jesus, we see here just right out of the gate that this is the first and the most fundamental step of discipleship. Discipleship just cannot be separated from intimacy with Jesus, from being with Jesus, from connection to Jesus. And I know that sounds like a really simple, really just straightforward thing to say, but it is so true. Discipleship cannot be divorced from just simply spending time with Jesus in his word, in prayer, in the corporate worship of his people. Spending intimate time with Jesus, being with him. We think of Acts chapter 4 when two of these apostles are going to be drugged before the council, and they're going to say, you know, we recognize two things about them. First of all, we recognize that they are uneducated men, but secondly, we also recognize that they have been with Jesus. Something about being with him was apparent to those who say, we recognize these people have been with Jesus. That is how we are disciples. That is how we make disciples of ourselves. That's how we make disciples of others, is we make disciples of ourselves by being with Jesus, by spending significant time with Jesus. We make disciples of others by helping others to see how to spend time with Jesus, by encouraging others to spend time with Jesus. It really is the starting point for everything. It really is the non-negotiable, fundamental foundation for everything of the Christian life, is intimate connection with Jesus, of being with Jesus. But we also see that not only is this discipleship to be a task, but it begins with a relationship, but this, we also see that this being with Jesus is something that we, I think, can maybe think of it sort of in romantic kind of terms of just this romantic idea of sitting at Jesus' feet. Like Mary, remember the Mary Martha story? And here's Martha working in the kitchen, but then here's Mary sitting at his feet, just sort of soaking up his attention or his teaching. And then Martha comes and complains. And then Jesus says, well, Mary has chosen the better. She's chosen to sit at my feet and to hear this teaching. And so we can kind of think of this being with Jesus as this idyllic sort of romantic notion of just peaceful communion with Jesus. Now, the disciples, the apostles, are going to be with Jesus in that way quite a lot. From chapter 4, verse 34, we're going to be told that there's this parable that Jesus tells that of the soils, and not everybody understands that. And so Jesus will take his apostles aside and privately explain it to them. Now, we don't know how many times something like that's going to happen. But over the next coming years with Jesus, that's going to happen untold numbers of times, where the apostles are going to have an experience with Jesus, time with Jesus that's close, up close and personal and intimate. They're going to be the recipients of teaching that the others don't receive. In particular, there's also going to be the three, Peter, James, and John, who we're going to see them spending even more significant time with Jesus. They're the ones who go on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus. They're the ones who go with Jesus to raise Jairus' daughter from the dead. They're the ones who are asked to pray for him the night of his arrest in Gethsemane. So we're going to see that they're going to have this time of peace, communion, close, intimate teaching and fellowship. But their time of being with Jesus, we should be careful to see, their time of being with Jesus is not just that. And neither is it for us either. The apostles being with Jesus is going to include, from this point on, every single trial that Jesus will endure up until his arrest. They will be with Jesus when Jesus has nowhere to lay his head. They will be with Jesus when he has nothing to eat. And like we saw from the previous stories, all they have to eat on the Sabbath day is just some heads of grain that they pick with their hands. They will be with Jesus when the Pharisees spew venomous hate toward him. They will be with Jesus when the Pharisees pick up rocks to stone him. They will be with Jesus when the crowds begin screaming to crucify him. They will be not at his side, but they will be sharing all these trials and tribulations up until the point that he separates himself to endure the arrest and the crucifixion alone. So their being with Jesus is going to include a tremendous number of trials and sufferings and hardships. So being with Jesus is both the peaceful, idyllic communion with Jesus and the hardships of suffering with him. As he's going to say in chapter 8, verse 34, if you're going to follow me, you're going to do it with a cross on your back, because you are going to die to yourself and you're going to pick up your cross and you're going to follow me. So the same is true for us. When we say, I want to be with Jesus, I want to be with him in this communing sort of way, we must also understand that being with Jesus involves suffering with him. It involves the hardships and the trials, which are necessary. Because without the hardships and the trials, there would be no way for us to know that being with Jesus means being with a powerful, trustworthy one who will bring us through. There's no way to know that Jesus is trustworthy aside from being with him through the trials. There's no way to know that. There's no way to know, unless you're on the boat with Jesus in the storm, there's no way to know that he is powerful, that he is faithful, that he is trustworthy, that those trials will pass and he will bring you through. It's like if you were to buy, say if you were to go down to the car lot tomorrow and you were to buy the biggest, baddest off-road vehicle they sell, 450 horsepower, four-wheel independent suspension, locking differentials, big old mud tires, and you drive off the lot with that off-road vehicle and you never take it off the pavement. And somebody comes and says, wow, this thing looks pretty awesome. What does this thing do in the mud? I don't know. I don't know if it goes through a mud puddle or not, because I've never taken it there. That's like the disciple who wants to be with Jesus but doesn't want the trials with Jesus, doesn't want to be on the boat in the storm with Jesus. It's only the trials that show you how powerful he is, how trustworthy he is, how faithful he is. So these disciples will be with Jesus through that. But then the other thing that we see here is that Jesus appoints these 12 apostles. And it's really helpful for us to remind ourselves that the ones he's appointing here, he's really appointing 12 nobodies. Scholars believe that the average age of the apostles when Jesus appointed them as apostles was their late teens. That throws a little bit of a different light on it, doesn't it? That these weren't men in their 30s. These were most likely men in their late teenage years who were themselves nobodies. They were fishermen. One was a tax collector. But I mean, there are no religious leaders. There are no leaders of any type. There is no one of any societal respect aside from possibly Judas. Aside from Judas, there's no one who garnered any sort of respect among the society. These were just plain nobodies whom Jesus chose to follow him and to become his apostles. Which shows us, once again, Jesus is wanting to clearly show us the value of what he will make these people to be, the value of what he will put into them instead of the value that they bring. They don't bring value to Jesus. They don't bring value to the table. It's what Jesus will make of them. Like 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. It's not the old jar of clay. It's the treasure inside the jar of clay. Or it's not, as Paul is going to say in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, it's not our strength that shows God to be strong. It's our weakness. It's our weakness in which he is strong. And so these 12 nobodies, they are made into what we will be told is the foundation of the church. For eternity, the church will exist as the church founded upon the 12 apostles. So these 12 nobodies, this group of late teenage years kind of fishermen and those whom, once again, eight of them, we're never going to hear from them again. This is what Jesus will take, and he will make his church from this. It's almost like, I was thinking of this analogy this week. It's almost like if we were to think of the robe of righteousness that Christ puts on us, right? We all know this robe of righteousness, that the Bible uses this as a metaphorical picture of the righteousness of Christ that we put on. So just imagine. Imagine the man who has this torn, ragged clothes. And, you know, he's got a shirt that's got holes all over it. It looks like he's changed the oil about 12 times in the shirt. And then he went and cleaned out the restroom down at the gas station in the shirt. And then he went and mucked out some stalls. And this shirt smells. It's ripped and torn and stained and faded from the sun. And he's got these pants with holes in them, and they're all faded and torn. And then Jesus gives to him this perfect robe of righteousness, this perfectly white, perfectly sewn, perfectly tailored robe of righteousness. And he takes off these filthy rags and he throws them to the ground and he puts on this robe of Christ's righteousness. And then he reaches down and takes that filthy shirt and puts it on top of the robe, and then takes the pants and pulls them up on top of the robe. This filthy, oil-stained, faded, torn-up old clothes, and he puts them on top of this perfect robe of righteousness. And then he says, not too bad, huh? I got a few holes, a couple of stains, but who doesn't, right? So glad I got the robe of Christ's righteousness. But then look at how this clothes, this shirt now fits on top of it. All the holes and the tears in the shirt, the robe of righteousness now covers those. You would say, what a fool. What a fool. But isn't that what we often do with the robe of Christ's righteousness? We seek to take our filthy garments and say, oh, I'm so glad I've got this robe of righteousness from Christ, but let me put this shirt back on top of it. This would be to kind of hearken back to some of the language of chapter 3. This would be like the new wine and the old wineskin, or this would be like the new patch and the old garment, to say, you know, that robe of righteousness is not compatible with those filthy rag clothes that you've got. That robe of righteousness cannot be worn in conjunction with those filthy old clothes of yours. Those need to be burned and thrown into the fire. Like the Ephesians threw their books of sorcery into the fire. Those need to be thrown into the fire and the robe of righteousness be the only covering. Jesus chooses 12 men who are nobodies that he can just take this robe of righteousness and he can make them into what he wants to make them into. And then as the Spirit comes to them and we see the picture of them in the New Testament, then we see the picture of people wearing the robe of Christ's righteousness. Now, one last thing. We'll see this in their equipping. Once again, from verse 14, he appointed 12 whom he named apostles so that they might be with him and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. So he's going to send them out with this twofold authority. The word authority there is not the word, your translation might have power, but it's the word exousia, which specifically means a delegated kind of authority, an authority from another. So Jesus is vesting them with the authority to preach and the authority to cast out demons. They don't have in themselves any sort of miraculous power, nor will they have any sort of miraculous power all through the book of Acts that's all their own. They will instead only have what Peter and John will say to the crippled man on the steps of the temple, silver and gold, I've got none, but here's what I can give you in the name of Jesus Christ. That's all that they will have is this delegated authority, this delegated power, but this authority is given to them twofold. First, to preach and to cast out demons. Now, here we see a correlation between the apostles and us because we are given the same authority. And I don't mean that we have authority to cast out demons. Instead, they're given the authority to preach, or in other words, to proclaim the way of salvation with authority. And they're also given the authority here to cast out demons. But what casting out demons means for us in our context is to show people the power, the expulsive power of the gospel in us. That's what the casting out demons is pointing to in us. In us, we have the authority to proclaim the message of life, the gospel that gives life, and also to proclaim what we talked about last week, the testimony of the power of that gospel in our life, of the preciousness of that gospel in our life. We are given the same authority, the delegated authority, to say to a watching world, here's the gospel that saves, and here's the power that that gospel has to cast evil out of your life. So may we too be those who clothe ourselves in the righteous robe of Christ, casting our ragged old garments into the fire,